Okay, if we could reconvene, that would be great. I'm Tom Merrill, Yale Law School, and also one of the faculty advisors in the Yale Supreme Court Law Clinic. And we'd like to continue our discussion. The first panel this morning was an attempt to sort of figure out what's going on. And the second panel will focus on whether it's broke. Now, there's a little bit of overlap. Some of the people in the first panel couldn't resist getting in their editorial slant. And I'm sure some of the people on this panel will have illuminating things to say about what's going on. We're quite blessed to have a variety of perspectives on the Supreme Court, people that have interacted with the court from different vantage points in society, including people that have been advocates, people that have been academic observers, and people whose work is reviewed by the Supreme Court. And I think we'll just go alphabetically. Everyone is pledged to stay within the five-minute time limit, and we'll have plenty of opportunity for inter-exchange on the panel and with the audience afterwards if we adhere to that guideline. So let's start with Lisa Blatt. Lisa was perhaps one of the all-time most successful Supreme Court litigators in the Solicitor General's office, which she recently left. Lisa.
Hi. Well, I think I'm going to be the contrarian because I actually think the cert selection process has been great, at least from the 13 years that I looked at it. Thinking back in just the last hour, I cannot think of a case that I saw that should have been granted that wasn't, and I can think of dozens of cases that should not have been granted that were. So I take it I have the opposite view. Although I did see it from the government perspective, I saw a lot of petitions that were filed against the government, and then a lot of cases where the court called for the views of the Solicitor General. And I think it comes from just a normative view on what you think is cert-worthy. My view has always been, and I think it's the court's view, is that you deny unless there's a reason to grant. And I think if your view is you grant unless there's a reason to deny, you think the court should be taking a lot more cases. And the way I always saw it, and I think the way I still see it, is the court basically takes cases on a sliding scale between circuit conflict and importance of the case. And if there's a circuit conflict that's recurring, it doesn't have to be that important of an issue. And if it's really important, there doesn't have to be a circuit conflict. And I think that's borne out by the statistics of the cases they've granted this term. But I do think that's a general rule, because I thought of three areas that I saw the court granting that sort of came up, and actually four areas that I saw over the years. And one is the original action cases. I mean, those are just in a category by themselves. The court seems like they've got to take those cases. There are a lot of patent cases that I think that's an area that the private bar cares about, but I think that that's not a circuit split area because of the cases can only arise out of the federal circuit. And every once in a while, maybe once every other term, I've seen what we call an outrage grant that the court grants because I think that they think the decision was wrong. They're very rare, and I think the private bar files a lot of petitions where the decision is arguably wrong, but there's no way the court is going to grant it. But every once in a while, and maybe the firefighters case is an example of that because there was no opinion issued, and people may have viewed that as an important case, whether or not they saw the decision was wrong. And then I do think that there's a lot of cases on the docket that involve the capital area, death penalty cases. And some of these cases come back to the court. You see them three, sometimes four times. It's the exact same case. I just think the court thinks it has a responsibility making sure it takes capital cases where there's important issues of sentencing. And I looked at the 43 cases. There's actually 44, but two of them involve the same issue, the life imprisonment for juveniles. And 27 of the cases, or 63% of them, did involve purported conflicts in the circuits. And they look like, you know, deep and square conflicts that more than just two circuits had weighed in on. And 15%, or 35%, involved what at least struck me as an important issue. There were several constitutional issues. There's the constitutionality of the Sarbanes-Oxley, the constitutionality of at least a First Amendment challenge to what debt relief agencies can advise under the 2005 bankruptcy amendments. There's the constitutionality of civil commitment of sex offenders. There's a patent issue. And there are several cases involving capital sentencing and habeas. And there's one attorney's fee cases, which I think is sort of just a routine administration of the law. And one thing that I noticed when I was looking over the docket, and I do think I have seen this increase over the years, and that is there's a lot of amicus briefs now filed at the cert stage that I think when I started in the SG's office I hadn't seen, and I counted 18 cases, which I thought was a lot, in which amicus briefs have been filed at the cert stage. Usually there were only two or three, but in the patent case there was a remarkable 8 amicus briefs filed, and I think that that's it was also interesting that there were amicus briefs filed in cases even when there was a circuit conflict. I think the parties were very smart, or the petitioner was smart, in saying, listen, not only is a circuit conflict, but this is important throughout the country. And the only thing I want to comment sort of on the last panel, I do think the amicus briefs, the sort of explosion of them, I think has contributed to a sense, at least on some members of the court, that they have more work to do. I have heard Justice Ginsburg comment that people don't appreciate how many amicus briefs, but there are tons and tons of amicus briefs just filed in that juvenile life imprisonment case. So I think that, I don't know if anyone's looked at how many have been filed in the past, but I think that they feel like that adds to their workload.
Okay, that's one vote for it ain't broke. Thank you, Lisa. John Payton of the NAACP Inc. Fund unfortunately couldn't be with us today because of a personal matter, but pinch hitting on his behalf is the very able John Sivan, who is also with the Inc. Fund and is an experienced Supreme Court advocate himself. Josh.
Thanks. I'm going to be more heretical than Lisa, I think, and say that in some respects, the Supreme Court right now is granting too many cases, reaching out to decide settled issues and overturn settled precedent. Just Lisa mentioned Ritchie. I think that there's an argument, and a good argument, that Ritchie didn't meet a lot of the settled cert criteria. There's a good argument that the voting rights case, Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District, could have been summarily affirmed. You can go down cases and the court is overturning precedent. So maybe too many cases is my first point. My second point is, and I think that if you look at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and its cases have declined markedly before the court, but in some ways that's a response to the court. The court has shut down a lot of areas of law, a lot of options that used to exist, ranging from the court's decision in Sandoval, which essentially shut down the ability of private plaintiffs to bring disparate impact cases under Title VI, or this term, I suspect that Iqbal will be a case which shuts down other areas of law. School desegregation cases, there were several cases in the mid-90s that made it much harder for those cases to continue. So that's the court. No surprise in response to those cases that there are less cases if they're decisively shutting down specific substantive areas of law. And I think that looking at the response to the cert pool, I have the distinction or the disadvantage of being probably the most recent person to participate in the cert pool among the panelists. And one of the most often inhibitions to granting cert was a vehicle problem. And I often felt like a used car salesperson trying to persuade or not persuade people to take a case. But a lot of the reasons why there are vehicle problems are in response to doctrines that the court has created or Congress has created to restrict access to courts. Standing has become an increasingly difficult area to get around and is often presents a vehicle problem. As well, AEDPA is an increasingly serious and difficult hurdle to go through. One area of cases that I think that the court doesn't grant a lot of, which is direct review of criminal cases. It could grant a lot more if it were serious about the constitutional issues at stake, and a lot of these cases are particularly troubling from state courts. But those cases tend to be, there's a presumption to do them through federal habeas review, but in federal habeas review, it's much more difficult to grant. And there were clerks in conservative chambers, I clerked for Justice Ginsburg, but in conservative chambers who expressed a preference while we were there for reviewing these cases more seriously on habeas review because it was easier to deny them. The other quick points that I'm going to make. I think that there is a lot more room for the court to be open to novel theories of law that have not yet made it into a distinct split, or cases that are not traditional cert splits, but yet the circuits and the district courts are gradually going in a direction that's really contrary to Congress's intent, whereas in some of the real issues around employment discrimination standards, where every once in a while it would be helpful for the court to come back and explain how some of these cases actually should get to trial and not all be dismissed at the summary judgment stage. And the final point that I wanted to make was that I think that one, going to the next panel and in terms of thinking about reforms, I'll just throw this out there for people to digest, is that if there is concern about vehicle problems, and often some vehicle problems that may appear to the clerks but not actually be vehicle problems, that the court could broaden the groups of people that it asks for the views of. So in addition to CVSG, you could have CVCC, Chamber of Commerce, or CVACLU, and bringing those views in at the cert stage, which is increasingly important, might be a way, if people think there is a problem, to expand that view, but I'm not sure there is a problem.
Thanks, Joss. I'm not quite sure how to score that one. You said there were too many cases, but then not enough cases overall in the system, but I'll leave that at that. Now we'll hear from Fred Schauer, polymath, law, and political science professor, who always has something interesting to say.
Up until now. The title of this symposium invites us to think about just what it is that is an important case. A number of people have referred to interesting cases. It might be useful to focus our attention just on the question of what makes a case important or what makes a case interesting. So in that sense, I want to say a few words first about just what we mean by important. In one sense of important cases, the court is not now taking important cases. It has not taken important cases in the past, and it shouldn't take important cases. By that, I mean if we measure importance by social or cultural or political importance, it turns out that most of the issues that are strongly important to the public, strongly important to political figures, that dominate the executive and legislative workload are pretty far removed from what the court is actually working on. And in that sense, rather than ask the question, how much of what the court does is important, we should ask the question, how much of what is important does the court work on? And if we switch the question in this way and either use the polling data on what the public actually thinks is most important, or instead look at the various different measures of what the press reports about or what Congress works on or anything else, we discover, and we don't even need the data for this, that issues such as healthcare, jobs, immigration, the economy in general, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and a large number of others dominate the political culture of the country, dominate public discussion, dominate public life, and are by and large issues pretty far removed from what the Supreme Court does. I wrote about this 3 years ago in the context of this conference. I updated the information, looking again at the relevant Harris polls, looking at various other things. Things have not changed. Healthcare is first, after the economy, broadly speaking, followed by a bunch of the other issues that I just mentioned. Abortion, affirmative action, sexual orientation, religion, speech, and the like very rarely make it into the top 20 issues of what the public thinks are the most important issues facing the country. Now, there's another sense of importance, of course. If we put aside the question of public or social or cultural importance and focus somewhat more narrowly on legal importance, it may still be the case that the court is suffering from a serious informational deficit or informational distortion that makes it difficult, if not impossible, for the court to have a systematic way of getting information about what is being litigated below, what is being disputed below, and what is uncertain or vague below. The reason for that is, first of all, it sees a very biased, in the non-bad sense, but statistical sense, a biased sample of disputes, a biased sample of litigation, a biased sample of contested events. And by only seeing the small and biased sample of cases that by virtue of the selection effect come before the eyes of the justices and their clerks, they may have a very bad or distorted sense of what is actually going on in the lower courts. Compounded by what the people who do the heuristics and biases research in behavioral economics and behavioral psychology would call the availability phenomenon. It is very difficult to avoid thinking that the cases that you are looking at are unrepresentative of the larger selection of events out there. If you're looking at a particular case, if you're looking at a particular scenario, you will think that that's representative of the world, even if it is not. One example of this, one anecdote being singular of data, Morse versus Frederick, the bong hits for Jesus case a few years ago. It's nice being a First Amendment specialist. People are more interested in what you have to say at cocktail parties than if you're an ERISA specialist. The bong hits for Jesus case was only the fourth student speech case that the Supreme Court had decided in 41 years, or 40 years. It turns out that there's a vast amount of lower court litigation about student speech. It turns out that the overwhelming proportion of lower court First Amendment litigation is either about government employees or student speech. The court takes four cases in 40 years. It takes a case that's stunningly unrepresentative in terms of the facts. It doesn't take cases involving Nazi regalia or Confederate flags or religious speech criticism of teachers or administrators or whatever. And having taken an unrepresentative case, it then decides it on remarkably narrow grounds and gives virtually no guidance to the lower courts that are dealing with these issues on a regular basis. So I'll conclude by a suggestion. I won't make it a prescription, but at least a suggestion. It relates a little bit to what we heard in the first panel about the desire of Justices Breyer and Alito maybe to do a little research about the cases that are not taken. Maybe it would be nice if some of the clerks were assigned the task of giving the justices the full lay of the land, even in cases it takes or cases that are close. Something that looks sort of like an old-fashioned student note from the 1960s. Every single lower court case, what's going on out there, what are the issues that are undecided. It's unlikely that this will come from the briefs. It's unlikely it'll come from amicus briefs. Only if the court itself takes on the task of trying to find out what's happening below will it be able to decide whether it is taking legally important cases or not.
Thanks, Fred. I take that as a vote that what's really broken are the student-edited law reviews. Which you may be right about. Steve Shapiro is A long time litigation head at the ACLU, very experienced advocate, and has a great deal of experience with the Supreme Court.
So since Bong Hits for Jesus was an ACLU case, and since Fred's description of it sounded very much like our op cert, I can only say that I would object less to the cert pool if Fred were in it. My general response to the first panel, I think, was to say, yes, you're all right. It seems to me almost inescapable that there is not a a single explanation for the decline in the court's docket, and that I think each of the theories that has been presented is plausible, and each probably contributes in some fashion or another. Do I think the system is broke? My answer to that would be no, but that's just because given where I sit, it's impossible for me to separate the prescriptive from the normative. And so if I ask myself the question, do I want this Supreme Court to take more cases? The answer to that is no, thank you. As I often say when I am asked to speak about the Supreme Court, I too began long enough ago that the court was hearing about 150 cases a year. They're now down to 75. When they get to the zero, I will head to the beach and consider a job well done. I think there is most of us, all of us want our cases to be granted, but at the end of the day, I have to say I have much more concern about how the court is deciding cases than how the court is deciding which cases to take. Among the theories, in the cases that we tend to be involved in, because they do tend to be high-profile ideological cases, I do think that the phenomenon that Lyle had described earlier of defensive denials plays a part. And there, too, I will say, if Justice Stevens does not think he has five votes, I'm happy to follow his lead and have the court deny cert. More often than not, one of the things that has not been talked about are the decisions of the Supreme Court bar about which cases to file in. And there, I think there actually may be a difference between what Richard was describing as the professional Supreme Court bar, and I do not know if he was including repeat organizational players like the ACLU in that context. I think of us as part of the professional Supreme Court bar, but I think we're driven by a slightly different set of imperatives because our case selection process is just a different process than the private bar goes through. And I will tell you, we are much more often now brought to the Supreme Court kicking and screaming as respondent than we are as petitioner. And as somebody who has been the filter for the Supreme Court cert petitions now for two decades, we are filing fewer cert petitions, and we are much more rigorous about the cert petitions that we file, although when I got a call from Yale asking if we kept statistics, I was a little embarrassed to say no. So this is just my impressionistic sense of it. We do not file cert petitions in abortion cases and take them to the Supreme Court. We do not file cert petitions, by and large, in race cases and take them to the Supreme Court. We do not file cert petitions, by and large, in religion cases and take them to the Supreme Court because the odds against winning those cases are really slim. There are some exceptions to that, but they are rare. And if you look at the affirmative cases that we are bringing to the Supreme Court, they are overwhelmingly, I think, free speech cases, and that is because this is a court that, for various reasons that we can discuss, still tends to be sympathetic to free speech claims, or at least perhaps more sympathetic to free speech claims than to other civil rights and civil liberties claims that might be presented to them. So I'm not saying that the diminished docket is a result of fewer ACLU filings, but it is certainly the case that we are asking the Supreme Court to review less than we once did, and I think it would be folly to do otherwise. The other thing I will say is, and this may be further support for Lyle's defensive denial, is that the decline of the docket is not simply statistical, but the emphasis on the docket has shifted. And the emphasis of the docket has shifted even under Chief Justice Roberts. The numbers may not have changed, but the court, it seems to me, is taking a different kind of case. And they're taking many more commercial cases than they once did. And I think there are at least two reasons for that. One is, as I said, I think the civil rights, civil liberties community is bringing fewer cases to them, but the converse of that is I think the business community is bringing more cases to them, and the reason the business community is bringing more cases to them is exactly the same reason. It's just the other side of the scale, which is they think they have a more sympathetic court and they're more likely to prevail, and those that are on their side on the Supreme Court can feel more confident, I think, in granting cert because they're more confident in the outcome, and the converse is that the liberal wing of the court, I think, is less confident of the outcome in many of these civil liberties cases, and therefore is more likely to vote to deny. And then the very final comment I will make is about the conflict. You know, I think if we were just two quick comments. One is criteria. I think if most of us were sitting around now and trying to from scratch devise the criteria that the court should employ in granting cert, we would come up, by and large, with the criteria the court uses, which is if there's a conflict among the circuits and a meaningful conflict among the circuits, the Supreme Court sits to resolve that conflict. And even in the absence of a conflict, if there's an issue of significant national importance, the Supreme Court ought to weigh in. Those are the criteria they use. I think that those are probably the right ones. But it's also the case, Justice White notwithstanding, not every conflict case merits review. I think in some cases the conflict may not be deep. In some cases the conflict may be on an issue that is not meaningful. And in more cases than I think we sometimes like to acknowledge, the conflict may be presented in a case that is simply not a very good vehicle. And one example of that I think has to do with immigration cases. Now there are a tremendous amount of litigation going around the country on immigration issues. Much of it is hyper-technical. Some of it has produced conflicts. The court may either think that those conflicts are not worth their time, or a lot of those cases, I think, are just not particularly well litigated and therefore don't present the issues particularly well. And it's understandable that the court does wait for another case in what they understand is a recurring vehicle. So I'll just stop there.
Thanks, Steve. So since you think 75 is better than 150, with this court, I will count you as not in the not broke column. But. You were more measured than that. We're very honored to have with us Judge Harvey Wilkinson from the Fourth Circuit. Judge Wilkinson, as everyone knows, has had an extraordinary and distinguished career, served for many years as Chief Justice of that court, and he will offer a very different perspective from that of all the advocates and analysts heretofore. He is someone who sits and watches his decisions being decided by the Supreme Court.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the Yale Supreme Court Clinic for the wonderful way in which they've organized this gathering, and how much I appreciate that. I don't think that this question here is a matter of who wins or who loses. From my perspective, it's not a strategic matter. I think there are an awful lot of neutral reasons to believe that the Supreme Court is hearing enough cases, and that if it decided on its own one term to hear 60 cases, I think that would be fine when you considered the relative importance of each one. Remember what happens when the court hands down a constitutional ruling. It's one size fits all. As I mentioned, when the court takes a big case, it accepts a risk that no other judicial body in the country does. And part of that risk is that things could go really wrong and that the mistake cannot be easily rectified. And that's a danger, and it's a particular danger in a complicated world in which unintended consequences are quite common. Remember that when the court gives an answer to a question, it cuts off a great deal of dialogue from other players in the system. To a significant degree, it cuts off legislative experimentation. It cuts off state experimentation, at least below the constitutional floor. It cuts off a dialogue among the federal circuits and among the state courts, at least as to questions of federal law. So if you have too many cases and too many constitutional rulings, what you're doing in the long run is depriving federal law of flexibility and depriving federal law of its diversity and depriving federal law of its dialogic quality. So yes, absolutely, there are cases on which the court should weigh in. But it's a tool that I think should be used sparingly and with a full awareness of how sweeping the consequences are. The major reason given for why the court should take more cases is because we need greater uniformity in law, and only a national court can provide that. But here again, the picture is a little more complicated than it may seem at first blush. I don't think that the lack of uniformity in American law is primarily a function of circuit splits. I think it's really more a result of our federal system and the fact that we have 50 states who are ruling on questions of both state and federal law all the time. That's really the major source of the lack of uniformity, and it's very hard to really police that. Now, if you want uniformity in law, there are many ways to get it, other than a Supreme Court ruling. One of those is through the legislative branch and the passage, for example, of strong preemption provisions. So when the Supreme Court rules on a case like Wyeth Laboratory, it may be a ruling on it's providing uniformity in one sense, because it's providing a uniform interpretation of the preemption provision. But on the other hand, it may not be providing uniformity in a larger sense, because the narrow ruling on preemption has left all sorts of actors free to go in their different ways. So once again, it's not always clear that a Supreme Court decision actually provides more uniformity. In fact, Supreme Court decisions often create disuniformity and imposing more questions than they answer. I've been critical of the Roe and Heller decisions and on various bases. And one of those is that they created disuniformity. They created so many subsidiary questions and answered relatively few. So I think we need to be at least to question the whole idea of whether Supreme Court decisions actually provide uniformity, because in fundamental ways, they may not. It may appear, that may depend also on the clarity of the decision. Some Supreme Court decisions are wonderfully clear, others less so. Fractured courts result. But there are just all sorts of ways for why I urge you to examine this premise that the Supreme Court is suddenly making national law entirely uniform. I want to confront a troubling aspect of the debate about whether the Supreme Court should accept more cases, and it's one that I think has been very unfair to the Supreme Court. And that aspect of the debate is that the justices don't have enough to do. That's not fair. And you just hear this in conversations. Well, their vacations are too long, or their clerks take so much work off their shoulders, or they spend too much time on speaking engagements and on television. And I don't think that's fair. I think those are really populist pot shots. And it's really not fair to the court or to the magnitude of the responsibilities that it carries. I want to make just one plea, and that is that the Supreme Court needs time for the formidable task that it's asked to perform. It's a much more complicated world now than it was in the beginning of the 20th century or during the 19th century. You get very complicated business cases which involve all sorts of difficult questions of law and economics. It takes time to master those. You get cases dealing on the cutting edge of technology. It takes time to understand the technology. The administrative state generates Byzantine regulations. If you were a justice in 1900, you got to interpret the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. And that's easier than going after ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code. So the justices' task, simply in terms of the textual matter that they are dealing with, is more complex today, because the world is more complex. There are two kinds of time, reactive time on a court, and there's reflective time on a court. When you're reacting to the crisis of volume, you don't have time to think things through. And the dilemma can be an especially acute one for the Supreme Court, because the tough cases and the hard decisions tend to back up toward May and June. And you can put circulation deadlines on for majority opinions, and you can say all the dissents need to be done by a certain time. But the cases are still going to come down to an end-of-term frenzy. Just having clerked there myself, I clerked for one of the great justices, Justice Powell, he often did not know the answer right away. He often changed his mind several times before he came to a conclusion. He often did his best when a case had the chance to marinate. Some of the best cases, some of the best decisions he wrote, some of the best decisions he made were those that he had the time to mull over. And I wouldn't go into particulars because it would be divulging confidential matters, but there were important developments in cases that hit late in the term, and I think the justices themselves might at some point recognize that if they had more time with them, they perhaps could have done a better job. The records in these cases are massive. No one has time to read every amicus brief. Even as a member of Congress, doesn't have time to read every bill. And they're complex enough in the terrain of law, particularly if we're going to consider, you know, questions of international import, where laws of various countries are going to come into play, where there's a danger of really missing things if you don't have time. Now, there was a case from Louisiana where the question was whether child rape would be subject to capital punishment constitutionally. And, you know, and I'm surprised this, I don't fault the court for it, I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, but the court missed a federal statute in the case. The Solicitor General's office missed a federal statute. We are moving too fast on some of this stuff when you consider what how complicated the world outside the judicial precincts are, and what how cases can boomerang on you in terms of their practical consequences. There's much more to say, but time is limited. But I would leave you with one just overall thought. Regardless of who wins or who loses, it just isn't a bad thing at all for the Supreme Court to have more time.
Thank you for those extremely thoughtful comments. Henry Hart's shadow finally pops up, the time chart of the justices. I'm not going to score that. I thought, let me see if I can summarize briefly what you sort of said. You said, first of all, that there's a trade-off between uniformity and percolation or allowing things to simmer for a while in a kind of competitive fashion. Secondly, that there are multiple sources of coherence building or uniformity building, not just the Supreme Court in our system. And lastly, that there's a trade-off between kind of quantity and quality, and that we need to be mindful about that. Those are all excellent points. Let me pose this question then to the rest of the panelists. Everyone has got their own perspective here on whether there ought to be more cases, fewer cases, more cases in this area, fewer cases in that area. Do the panelists think that the Supreme Court is providing inadequate services to the nation in terms of reducing the incoherence or the chaos in our legal system? Are we suffering from a lack of uniformity production because of the Supreme Court's decline in its caseload? That would seem to be maybe the most basic question that we need to address when we talk about caseload analysis. Anybody want to react? Fred?
It's for those, I'm not sure I would put it in terms of uniformity. I would put it in terms of guidance. For those of us who think there ought to be more guidance from the Supreme Court, not only to lower court judges, but also to the cop on the beat, teachers, legislators, and so on, it's not at all clear to me that the number of cases is the chief culprit. It may be that case-specific, fact-specific opinions that don't give very much guidance is much more of a problem than taking too few cases. With the existing number of cases, if the court were to set forth, dare I say it, a rule or something that looked more rule-like than what it is now doing, that could be understood more easily by lower court judges, by legislators, by members of the executive branch, by, if not the cop on the beat, the people who write the manuals for the cop on the beat, then I think some of the problem, I'm not sure I'd call it chaos, might be solved. I wouldn't think that number of cases is the chief culprit.
Anybody else want to weigh in? Steve.
Well, let me just say, as somebody who practices in front of the Fourth Circuit, I agree with everything Judge Wilkinson said. But I also agree with what Fred said. I think that what I find more troubling sometimes is not when the Supreme Court denies cert, leaving a circuit conflict intact and unresolved, but when the Supreme Court takes a case, it decides a case, and you're finished reading the opinion and think there are more unanswered questions than answered questions. And I think my sense of that, though, is that part of that is a function of a very closely divided court. And a very closely divided court looks to the least common denominator in order to get to five. And often that means eliding some of the more difficult questions in the case. And so I don't think it's a question of numbers, as Fred was saying. I think it's sort of tied up with the court's decision-making process, and that itself is on the merits, and that itself is a very obviously complicated subject to discuss.
Other reactions? Josh?
One area, and I say this cautiously because I'm not sure that the court will always come out the way we want it to, but there are some areas of the law where a pronouncement from the Supreme Court is very important to the development of the law. And I'm thinking, for instance, of the student strip search case that came out this term. And under 1983, there's not only the question of whether there's a constitutional violation, but in terms of liability, it's whether that constitutional violation was clearly established. And so the court in that case said that there was a violation, but it wasn't clearly established, so no damages. And if the court isn't taking those cases and making the constitutional pronouncements, the development of liability for those cases, effective deterrence, will be slow to develop. Now, if the court says it takes lots of those cases and says there are no constitutional violations, I think we'd be very concerned. So it's a be careful what you wish for. But I think that that is a type of area where pronouncements from the Supreme Court at some point are useful in terms of uniformity.
I would just add, from a government perspective, it seems for regulated parties, because the court is faced with a particular fact pattern, they're very good at answering questions, but a regulation or an act of Congress is a much more efficient way to give guidance and to govern primary conduct. And a lot of what times happens is the agency in Congress is, you know, not able to act for political reasons, or they can't make a policy judgment, and then it forces a court decision. But it's much more efficient to just write the law and state what the answer is.
Yeah, Peter Strauss at Columbia has this very interesting article, which he wrote back when the court was taking 150 cases a year, but he suggested that the development of the Chevron doctrine in administrative law, where courts are being instructed more to defer to agencies, would be a functional substitute for Supreme Court oversight of the development of federal law. You obviously, you typically only have one federal agency, so if everybody follows what the agency says, you're not going to get conflicts and inconsistencies. And so, and this picks up on what Judge Wilkinson was saying. I think there are other mechanisms for bringing coherence to the system, legislation, administrative law, and so forth.
You know, Tom, and I think that's an excellent point, and one of the most helpful Supreme Court decisions, I think, in recent years has been Pearson v. Callahan, which gave the lower federal courts the option of whether to treat the question of a federal constitutional violation first or whether to answer the qualified immunity question first. That just gave us enormous flexibility, perhaps almost akin to what Chevron gave administrative agencies. And there's a way in which the Supreme Court can hand down devolutionary decisions, and I think that Chevron is an example of that, and I think Pearson v. Callahan is an exception to that, and also reduce docket pressures on its own. Because if the Supreme Court in a 1983 case has a federal court answering a federal constitutional question wrong, then that's a more likely candidate for cert than if the federal court says, well, we don't know what the answer to the federal constitutional question is, but there wasn't a violation of clearly established law. And this feeds into the point, too, that somebody was making, which I thought was an excellent case, that in the capital punishment case and in many, many direct appeal questions, if the Supreme Court's going to deny it on direct appeal, it's going to get it on collateral review on a much more deferential standard. And I don't think this is wrong. When you add up cases like Chevron and Pearson v. Callahan and the reluctance of the court to take some criminal cases on direct review and wait for the 2254 petition, these decisions all have one thing in common, and that is that they're devolutionary in terms of giving dispersing authority throughout the system. And I happen to think that that's a healthier development than trying to answer it all right from on high. These are really good practices, and I hope they will continue.
So, somewhat to my dismay, this panel is rather Panglossian about the current situation. Lisa, at the outset, was afraid that she was going to be flayed by saying that the court is taking the right number of cases. I can't imagine that the audience is in complete agreement with this sentiment. So, why don't we take some questions from people in the audience? Sandy.
Just
interested
in both a prediction and a normative comment
on whether you think the court will or should grant cert with regard to what appears to be a conflict between the Ninth Circuit, the Seventh, and the Second Circuits on the incorporation of the Second Amendment against the states.
Why don't the ACLU chief take a crack at that one?
Well, we didn't file in Heller, so I don't have any dog in this fight. I think the answer is it's clearly a question that they have to resolve, and so this is one of these things that, if not now, shortly, I think. But if I had a guess, my guess is that they will take it.
It's an interesting example. I'm not going to predict, but it is an interesting example in the sense that, unlike some number of other cases and unlike the standard wisdom about the enormous value of the case and controversy requirements, this may be an issue in which a great deal of factual detail will not supply substantial additional information. In the spectrum of pure legal question or on one end and fact-specific on the other end, this one looks pretty pure legal. Getting 30 or 40 or 90 fact situations and looking at one in particular may not help very much. So if it's undecided, I'm not sure in the getting information sense that waiting is going to help a great deal.
Certainly, a non-incorporation ruling would be consistent with the devolutionary spirit that Judge Wilkinson was talking about. Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, David. Yeah.
I guess I'm a question. So one of the things I've theorized about in terms of the declining docket, one reason why it might be bad, and I'm going to take some issue a little bit with what Judge Wilkins had said, although I have to be careful because I'm going to see him next month at a conference, is it seems that when you have a smaller docket, the court feels more pressure to pronounce broad declarations of law. So, you know, I recently did a paper about the early 1900s court, and take into account that it was a much less complicated world. It was very much common law decision making, very short and sweet opinions, trying to decide the question before them, and not trying to write a law review article or a treatise on a particular area of law. And when you have those pressures, it feels like the court may feel more more bound or more pressure. This is our only crack at it for the next 5 or 10 years. So we need to lay the field. You know, we need to lay everything out on the field. And I'm not sure that that's a good thing. And so I'm just curious what the panelists think about that.
David, I'm not sure. Do you think your thesis bears up historically, because the Warren Court was one of the most activist courts in the history of the country, and they were doing it at the time when the court was granting, I don't know, 130, 150 cases a year. I mean, it seems to me if the justices want to be more activists, they're going to be more activists, and if they don't want to be more activists, they're not going to be more activists. But the counter thesis to yours is that the more cases there are, the more chances for mischief. And I do think that the large number of cases, your theory that a large number of cases will lead to a narrower rulings, I'm not sure that's true, because in the heyday of the Warren Court, the larger number of cases just led to more intrusive rulings.
Right, and it's not so much activism I'm talking about, but Olympianism. There's a lot of recent law review articles on the court being very Olympian in its rulings. But your point is well taken on the Warren Court.
Certainly the amicus filings would suggest that as the caseload gets smaller, you get more amicus briefs per case, and perhaps more amicus briefs also induces the court to think more like an agency promulgating a rulemaking or something like that, because it's getting all this testimony from different sides about what the rule ought to be. So that, I think, somewhat corresponds with your insight that the smaller docket may be inducing the court to think that it has to be more decisive or comprehensive in the way it resolves things. So whether that's good or not, I don't know. Yeah.
Would be interested in your theory, devolutionary theory, about the sentencing guidelines after
your theory, devolutionary theory after Booker and, you know, Kimbrough, et cetera, and it seems like the courts
yeah.
are.
Well, from the Court of Appeals perspective, Justice Stevens's opinion in United States v. Gall was a godsend, and it was very devolutionary in several ways, because it gave district courts a greater degree of discretion, so it was devolutionary to district courts, and it also was devolutionary to a court of appeals because they were reviewing under a reasonableness and abuse of discretion standard. So that's an example of what I'm talking about in terms of devolutionary jurisprudence. And United States v. Gall was just wonderful, and Rita too, from the standpoint of the lower federal courts. The decisions like that in Pearson v. Callahan have been very lower court friendly, and have been very, very welcome. And that decision, you know, was very clearly written, and it was very clearly understood what would be done, and I think it's cut down on not necessarily the number of sentencing appeals to the Court of Appeals, but it's, I think, reduced pressure on the court to take sentencing cases, which, beginning with Apprendi, it was taking them all the time to find out what the sentencing guidelines meant. But now it's relieved of that pressure, and I think your question just illustrates a wonderful example of what we've been talking about.
Tom? Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, though, the decisions in the sentencing cases are a court that was taking cases to clarify the laws in areas which were actually really not within keeping of the traditional cert guidelines, it was hard to say that there were real clear splits that had percolated on a lot of these issues. The court took several cases in quick succession to clarify the implications of its sentencing resolution in Booker and Blakely, and that ferment and that clear guidance, I think, is a counterexample of the court taking a lot of cases to clear up an area that could have gone on as unsettled. I also wanted to make one point with respect about Pearson versus Callahan, which I think is a terrible decision. And I don't think it's necessarily consistent with devolutionary, well, there are multiple meanings of devolution. If one meaning is to take it out of the purview of the Supreme Court and not to resolve issues, that could be seen as devolutionary. But in terms of experimentation, development of the law, I'm not sure how the law develops in the 1983 realm, in the constitutional rights realm, without forcing courts to march through, first, the constitutional analysis, is this a violation of constitutional rights? And then second, is it clearly established? If you just allow courts to deal with the question of, is this clearly established, courts will have an inkling to say, no, it's not clearly established, or at least there's a debate about this, and a result, there ever actually never is that right clarified, and as a result, people suffer from what may ultimately be deemed constitutional abuses, and as a result, justice is denied.
So, yeah, sure.
Just for people looking for an interesting social science research project, it might be interesting for psychologists or economists or political scientists to do a serious empirical research project on the extent to which judges of courts of appeals, district courts, and the like have preferences for uncertainty or preferences for guidance. One of the issues is, if you are a judge, do you want the freedom that uncertainty, devolution, and discretion gives you, or do you want the guidance from the last word? It's just a question.
One thing to add, just on the sentencing guidelines and the Heller comment, I mean, every once in a while you see a wave of a certain issue come through the court, and sometimes it produces fatigue when it, I think, creates emotional distress, and the court's just tired of an issue, and then every other once in a while they have this inexhaustible energy, and I think Apprendi started that, and it was even before Apprendi, and finally it's kind of settled. And I think we're still seeing the confrontation clause on that. They've gotten on a confrontation clause kick, and it hasn't ended yet. And whether Heller is one of those things that now they've done it, they don't want to look at it again, or they realize, no, we're going to keep going on this, it'll be interesting to see.
So they need more than a personal trainer on the court. They need to... So let me pose this question. Several of the panelists and audience members have suggested that perhaps it's not the numbers that's so important, but the cases that are decided, and that we don't want idiosyncratic cases with weird facts, and we don't want unrepresentative cases, and we want cases that perhaps are more institutional in the sense that they might create the conditions for devolution or proper structuring of relationships between institutions as opposed to just deciding narrow issues. This is kind of to be a segue into the next panel, but I'll pose it here. Is the current institutional setup that the court has for picking cases adequate if one of the objectives is to make sure that we're picking the best cases in order for the court to expend its finite energies in deciding?
From a court of appeals perspective, I think the court does a pretty good job in taking the important cases. I try to divorce myself from what I suppose might be an institutional bias. It's, you know, it's a very happy thing to live in a world of cert denieds. at least if you're in the majority, if you're dissenting, you might want to live in a world of cert granteds. But given the volume of cases that the Supreme Court has, I look at the cases that they grant, and I say to myself, the ones that they granted, yeah, I have to admit to myself, that was pretty hard on the Court of Appeals level. That case was actually pretty close, and I did think that was important. And I have the intuitive sense, I know Roy was saying that some things had seemed inextricably to fall through the cracks, but by and large, I think the judges on our court feel that they do a pretty good job of picking out what's important. I realize that's anecdotal and not empirical, but I don't, you know, this is so much in the eye of the beholder. One person's relatively inconsequential case may be another person's terribly important case. But I clerked on the court the last year before the cert pool went into effect, and the first year I clerked for 2 years, and then I clerked for Justice Powell the first year that the cert pool went into effect. And the cert pool's taking a lot of flack these days, but at the time that it was instituted, it was thought to be a marvelous development and something that would help the justices get on top of the large number of certiorari petitions. And it was really welcomed, particularly by Justice Powell, and I know he felt that, particularly toward the end of the term, each chambers did not have the chance to really give the cert petitions a hard look when they were dealt with on an individual chambers by chambers basis. And some of them we weren't looking at hard at all. We were relying on the Solicitor General's office. We were relying on the Chief Justice doing the job through the discuss list. And the individual chambers were not considering certiorari petitions conscientiously, as conscientiously as they should have been. And so there was a reason the cert pool went into effect, and it was to give the justices the assurance that every petition had at least one conscientious hard look, and you could supplement that in an individual chambers if you were interested in doing so. But I think the cert pool was a beneficial development, and if you want to throw it out, what's the alternative? You have to sort of think through that proposition too.
For which we have another panel. Yes, Steve.
Yeah, no, all I was going to say is I think that the cert pool, for the reasons Judge Wilkinson was saying, is unavoidable, although I also think it is beneficial to always have some members of the court who are not participating in the cert pool. I think a cert pool which captured all nine chambers would be a bigger problem. And I just wonder, somebody I'm sure in this room knows the answer, and maybe Judge Wilkinson knows half of it. The number of cert petitions that were being filed in the last year before the cert pool was instituted and the number of cert petitions that was filed last term. I don't know if you know that number off the top of your head, Lyle, but the number has gotten so, Roy, do you know?
The number has been 2,000 petitions constantly for several years. The IFP document has grown exponentially.
Yeah.
The number of paid petitions has stayed right around 2,000 for.
Yeah, well, I think that even with 2,000, there's inevitably going to be some sort of screening mechanism. You're not going to get nine chambers analyzing 2,000 cert petitions with care. I think it's just not going to happen. And if it's not a cert pool, it's going to be the SG's office or some other screening mechanism. And so I think yes, there are problems associated with the cert pool, but as long as it's not uniform and unitary, I think it's with us.
And for those of us who think that the problem is a deep structural informational deficit and a deep structural informational distortion, I don't think any tinkering with the screening mechanism one way or another is not going to solve that.
Yeah, to me it seems like the basic problem is that the people that need to be deciding the key cases, the ones that are truly relevant to institutional choice and so forth, are the ones with the most experience in the legal system. We have these relatively inexperienced people using mechanical proxies as the initial screen, and so you've got a disconnect there. Maybe the court itself can bridge that gap, but it strikes me that it's potentially a problem.
Unless you just take the advice of the Swiss law and write another 140-year term.
All right, well put. Why don't we take a quick break? Our next panel is supposed to reconvene at 11:45. Thanks very much.